Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008. Joining us on the line, Sanusha Naidu, Senior Research Associate at the Institute of Global Dialogue. Sanusha, good morning. I have no idea how to segue from the conversation I have just been having to a conversation about Jacob Zuma. For the life of me, I can't figure it out.
Good morning to you and the listeners. I'm not sure myself. I'm not sure what the thread is.
There is no thread. It's just ramblings, which I guess is something like we're seeing around the Jacob Zuma case. There it is. For years, he's been telling us he wants his day in court. He wants to prove his innocence. And now he seems to be doing everything to avoid just that.
That's curious, doesn't it? I think the challenge for Mr. Zuma is that on the one hand, he needs to show that and demonstrate he's innocent. But on the other hand, these affidavits, I mean, this affidavit of over 140 pages, and I think what Advocate Mpo did yesterday was just summarize the three core points around why they feel Advocate Downer should not be the prosecutor on the case, tells you that it's really very, very difficult to understand how you want your day in court, but at the same time, you're objecting to the advocate. Now, you know, Mr. Zuma has a right to do that. He's in terms of his legal rights, he's entitled to do that. He feels that he's not going to get a fair hearing or the trial will be compromised by the lack of objectivity by Advocate Downer. He has every right to do that. But what I find curious is that when you read the affidavit, and it's very long, so I haven't read the whole thing, but just the truncated parts that I read, you can see that there's an interesting correlation. He's claiming that Mr. Downer would not be objective, and so he's asking the judge to review Mr. Downer's ability, objectivity, and ability to give him a fair trial. But what he's also saying is that if the judge finds that there is a kind of reasonable doubt that can be said that Mr. Downer has, in terms of the affidavit put forward, is not necessarily going to be objective, then the next thing in the affidavit that Mr. Zuma's lawyers and himself are asking for is he must be acquitted. Now, that doesn't mean that you have sorted out your issue of the charges. You're actually using a kind of loophole, which is, I think if I heard one of the lawyers yesterday talk about this loophole, is that it's already been adjudicated and a judgment has come forward from the Supreme High Court, from the Supreme Court, of the full justices of the Supreme Court, where they've ruled that you can't have it both ways. If you object to somebody who is a presiding officer in your case, you have within your rights to do that. That's your constitutional right. But then you can't go and then put a kind of addendum or a claimer to that to say, well, now you have to basically acquit me of the charges. There's two separate issues here.
Of course. So in other words, you can't conflate the two. It's like, you know, it's I guess like the American system saying, well, I'm objecting to that particular juror because they hold very strong opinions on ABC. But it doesn't mean because you've objected to that juror that the case falls away.
Yeah. So the case, I mean, the charges are something very serious. And there are definitely charges that have come back. Now, I have to go back and exercise my memory in terms of 2005, where Shabir Sheikh was charged with corruption. Right. I'm not sure whether Mr. Zuma, he was not charged, but then the case was then considered to be, or the charges against him were dropped because they said there was this whole question of political interference. And if you listen to Advocate Mpo yesterday, he was bringing that back.
I noticed
political interference and so forth.
Right. The ANC seems to have a bit of a playbook, don't they? So they'll go with a conspiracy theory. Or first they'll go with the fact that it's all lies. Then they'll go and then they'll say they want their day in court just to prove it. Then they'll come up with this third force, or maybe an international silent crew who they don't seem to, who they can never name. And then ultimately we land up with a poison plot that has something to do with Russia. It all seems to follow this very, very strange, trajectory, almost.
I mean, I think in this case, it's not Russia, it's the CIA, linking back to Leonard McCarthy, and that there was all kinds of darkened corners and hidden transactions that were taking place, and he was talking, you know, as the spy boss, he was talking to the former, he was talking about the case with former CIA colleagues and whatever. So there's this whole kind of interesting, intricate, complex web of conspiracies that have been put together. But I think it's not just the ANC in general. I think it's the way particular individuals in the ANC articulate the narrative of a kind of political conspiracy against them, and how they utilize the web of that narrative to weave a very convoluted set of issues. It's very plain and simple. We're talking about corruption here. We're not bringing in third party forces. We're not bringing in external actors. This is about a case where there's questions about whether or not Mr. Zuma allegedly was involved in corruption. Now, he's also trying to, I mean, this is what you do when you muddy the waters. If you always want to put it forward and say, you know, I'm not really responsible, but I want my day in court. But then what you do outside the court is also very important, because there were like almost three cases in one there. There's the court of Judge Kuhn, there's the court, there's the court proceedings against Billy Downer, and then there was the court outside the High Court. That was a different type of setting that was emerging in terms of challenging that whole perspective. So I think it's a tactic that, you know, as people are calling it, a Stalingrad kind of tactic, but it's definitely a tactic that comes from how you perceive the optics and what you want the optics to do. So outside of court, I found it very, very interesting. I mean, apart from the fact that, you know, you had all these people there who were not social distancing, mask wearing was very minimal. I mean, I think that was just reckless for a party, and particularly leaders who talk about they have the interest of the vulnerable and the poor and the marginalized at heart in terms of this economic transformation agenda they're talking about, but just basically allow people to come there and don't actually enforce social distancing rules. You're actually putting people at risk. And today, the numbers show that we're etching up quite fast to 5,000 infections a day. Once we hit 5,000 over a sustained period of time, we're in a third wave. So I can't understand this. I mean, that alone should be whether or not you really care for the people. But at the same time, I think the narrative that then gets portrayed on that stage in terms of what you put forward and how you put it forward is also very important, because you create binary issues. You create binary spaces, and it's us and them. And of course, there's the whole question of confusion now about the step-aside rule, whether Ace Magashule could be there. Listening to the Deputy Secretary General on Tuesday, giving us the briefing on the NWC meeting, saying that she spoke to him. It just seems to me that the defiance has become endemic, and that they just, you know, nobody seems to be taking these rules seriously, and they are defying it and saying, come after us and let's see what happens. And I think that again is something that's completely out of sync in what we are looking at. And then finally, you know, I think there was a moment there where we saw the former president's son being asked to speak. And again, if you read between the lines, and the optics were very clear, this guy is being pushed as the possible contender for a kind of senior position in the party, but also in terms of being groomed as possibly the contender and the successor for a presidential position.
Keep wondering if perhaps it's better this way, because can we not deal with it better now that we know that there isn't a pretense anymore, that Jacob Zuma, Ace Magashule, that crew is very, very clearly acting in defiance of its own party and is standing up for whatever it is that they want to achieve, and I can't even possibly imagine the depth of all of that. But to some extent, doesn't it make it easier for the ANC to eventually reach a point that says, all right, party, you now need to decide if you are moving forward on the side of corruption or on the side of accountability? To some extent, does this not play in to Cyril Ramaphosa's hands?
I mean, I think kind of in a way that you put it across, I think you kind of replaying Nasrec all over again. But it's becoming, I mean, in Nasrec it was much more difficult in terms of trying to, I mean, you knew what was happening,
yes.
but it wasn't as blatant as you say. You know, it wasn't as kind of explicit as you say. Now the gloves are off and the gauntlets have been thrown down and everybody's now moving into their own kind of battlefields. So I think that's part of the optics you see. And you're right. I mean, it may play into Ramaphosa's, angle that he's trying to purge the corruption in the party, clean up the party, and that he now himself has become frustrated. And so it's no more Mr. Nice Guy, I'm taking it to you. But then the reaction is, you know, you see Ace Magashule playing into these very, very, interesting, if not, facetious kinds of optics. You know, you watch him in a boxing, ring and doing his little boxing shows and whatever and showing his might. And I think the problem is that the optics then become much more of the interest and not necessarily whether the party is actually doing what it's supposed to. And so you get caught up in that more than you actually get caught up in the fact that a lot of what the party said is going to be doing in terms of purging and in terms of addressing the question of accountability, Murphians and other levels of bad governance, not just corruption, just the fact that, you know, you've got people in the party who have now become completely, taken the party in a way where they've become bigger than the party or want to become bigger than the party, which has always been a non-starter for the party. I mean, that was precisely part of the reasons why you had Polokwane, you had this whole challenge around, Mbeki and others who didn't need to be, who were told you can't get bigger than the party. But I think we're beginning to see that. The problem is that we then concentrate on these optics and that, we keep wondering now what's the next move by the Cyril Ramaphosa camp. Now, the patience that the party shows to allow leaders to do the right thing is just amazing. I mean, sometimes it's just bizarre that you continuously allow these leaders to, or these individuals and personalities to continue to push the envelope and push the parameters of what they can do, even if you have a step aside role. I mean, immediately after the NWC report, that Jesse Duarte spoke, you see this whole thing unfold yesterday outside the court. And then you have to ask yourself, you know, do they take these things seriously? And I think that's the challenge. The question is, where's going to be the decisive action now? You can't keep having the patience. You can't keep having this idea that our internal processes are here. Because I think the internal processes tend to basically upend a lot of what should be decisive action.
Absolutely, and unfortunately we do need to leave it there. Sanusha Naidu, fascinating perspective, Senior Research Associate at the Institute for Global Dialogue.